Think is made possible by Guaranty Bank, Perot Systems, Southwest Securities, and the Executive Education Center at the University of Texas at Dallas.
Welcome to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. As the ongoing recession affects how people live, what impact is it having on where people live? And what can we learn from the dangerous instability within the mortgage markets that helped trigger the crisis? Former Secretary of Housing and Urban Development Henry Cisneros is here to offer his insight into the problem. He's in town to deliver the keynote address at the North Texas Housing Coalition's 10th Annual Summit. Henry, welcome to Think.
Chris, thank you. And I'm glad you make us think.
Happy to do it, especially with people like yourself. Will you start by talking about where you think the lion's share of the responsibility ultimately will have to fall for what's happening?
Unfortunately, I think there is ample blame to be placed around the table. Lots and lots of folks. This thing had many elements, and frankly, it's a kind of a cumulative process that occurred over many years. We had liquidity in the world markets, oil-fueled liquidity, interest rates that were kept low for a very long time, and Alan Greenspan is now being criticized for having kept interest rates too low after the tech bust in order to keep the economy from going under. So there was a lot of money out there looking for places to park. Meanwhile, the government, I was part of it, was pushing home ownership. I think it was a laudable objective. I didn't expect that it would be hijacked by some elements who went over the line in terms of predatory retail instruments that required no documents and no stated income and
liar
so forth.
Liar loans, as they call them.
Liar loans, as they call them. We went then Wall Street figured out that there was this huge source of money to be made by packaging these more expensive, lucrative mortgages, which were necessarily the riskiest mortgages, and sent pushing them off into that pool of global capital. So people out all over the world, the German retirement system, the Chinese bank, were buying these mortgages globally, which is what made this a global contagion, right? Rating agencies were looking the other way at the risk involved them. So the rating agencies, Moody's and Standard & Poor's, were also involved. You had Wall Street executives who were compensated on the basis of how much money they made, and these, you could make more money selling these things than more responsible product. You had the government regulators sort of looking the other way at these CDOs and SIVs, these hedge fund strategies for packaging these things. You had individuals who had no business buying homes and yet fell prey or complicit in lying about their income and so forth to get bigger house, more house. So there was plenty of blame all around the table, public sector, private sector, Wall Street, retail brokers, and individual people who engaged in fraudulent practices. And the result was this housing boom where prices went up. You had speculators out there who had no intention of living in the homes, just flipping them as quickly as they could. And we had this perfect storm, this witch's brew of actions that resulted in this huge crash.
You were on the board of Countrywide for several years, including on its audit and ethics committee. Bought and sold about $5 million of Countrywide stock. Did you think at the time that you were on the board that this was a fundamentally sound company?
You know, my involvement in this situation has several elements, and it's been well documented, including a front page story in the New York Times that begins with when I was Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. We concluded, let me digress for 2 seconds on that. We concluded in about 1995 or 6 that the economy was doing very well, what ended up being the longest expansion in American history during the Clinton years, with low interest rates and high employment and so forth, that we could surpass the all-time high home ownership rate, put more people into homes, which is a good thing, and increase the minority home ownership rate very dramatically. So we set in motion policies to do that. I don't apologize for those. I think that was the right thing. When I left government and became president of Univision and created my own company later, I was invited on the board of what at the time was the largest provider of mortgages for Americans Countrywide, with the largest number of mortgages for minority Americans. It was the right thing to do. Angelo Mozzillo was getting every award as best employer, best company, best stock performance in 25 years, et cetera, because it was basically writing the mortgage. So to answer your question, It was a good company, an honorable company, but fell victim to the same kind of practices that beset the rest of the industry and the country. Countrywide felt that in order to compete with the subprime companies, it needed to move more in that direction, against its own best judgment, but was going to lose market share, was going to lose stock market position and so forth. And so they went where it was not wise to go. And unfortunately, relied heavily on a broker network that weren't even employees of the company, but people paid on commission, which, think of it. Think of what you set in motion when you compensate people on what they sell. They're incentivized then to sell the most expensive product because they make more commission, right? But what's the most expensive product? The riskiest product. And Countrywide got itself in trouble.
So what needs to happen now for these neighborhoods that are dotted with empty foreclosed homes?
Yeah. I like to respond to what needs to be done with a kind of a four-part strategy. The first is we have to help people who have already been hurt. And that's the foreclosed neighborhoods you're describing. They're people and they're communities with boarded up houses, with graffiti, vandalized. I have been to neighborhoods, for example, in South Florida, no exaggeration, where of five houses on the block, literally two or three are boarded up. And there's places like that all over the country, in the Midwest, in the Rust Belt, in Cleveland, for example, in the Inland Empire in California, San Bernardino, Riverside, etc. So step one is to use the stabilization funds that have been created to buy those homes, fix them, and put people in them, whether they be affordable home ownership or even rentals, but take them out of the vacant status where they're a blight.
Are you more enthusiastic, excuse me, today about rental than you were before? Do you think there is?
I think we need more balanced housing policies. I was an advocate of home ownership, but not to the exclusion of rental, because there are people who cannot become homeowners. They're not at that point in their career, their age, their life, their income. But clearly, the new Secretary of HUD will have to put a greater emphasis on rental. Let me just quickly run through the other pieces.
Sure.
So first is we've got to help people who have been hurt. Second is we've got to help people who are going to be hurt. There's still 2 to 5 million people with adjustable rate mortgages that are going to explode over the next couple of years and who could become victims of foreclosure. That will be horrible for this economy, because while we're trying to drain the barrel of the stock of foreclosures and the inventory supply that exists out there, while we're trying to drain the barrel, we're going to be filling it from the top end with more foreclosures, destroying confidence, damaging the bank balance sheets, and overall being negative. So that's what this TARP strategy is, of spending money on foreclosure modification, getting the banks to forbear with people and extend the periods of the loans, lower the interest payments, lower the mortgage payment so families can stay in their homes. The third piece is we got to make sure this doesn't happen again. So the broker piece, the rating agencies piece, the abusive retail paper, the Wall Street instruments, the oversight on the part of regulatory bodies, all of that needs to be addressed. And then finally, we've got to figure out how to get housing reintegrated into the economy, because it's the housing sector, between housing construction, materials, transporting those materials, appliances, is about 20% of GDP. You can't have 20% of GDP on the sidelines and expect this economy to recover. We have people who need housing. We have people who need affordable housing. So we've got to get the housing sector back on its legs and part of the bill back.
So people ask this question about whether or not the housing sector is too large to fail. Is it safe to say it's already failed or is failing?
Oh, I think it's as close to failure as we have seen. This week, the annual estimates for what production would be if a month were continued for a year were released, and it's down about 550,000 units from roughly an average sort of 1.2, 1.3 million in a normal year, and 1.7, 1.8, 1.9 million units per year sold of new homes over the last several years. So we're like a third of our normal level of production, with housing starts down, prices still dropping, families not able to get credit. Housing sector is very near disabled.
Being foreclosed upon is traumatic no matter what the circumstances by which it's happened. But I wonder if you think it's even possible to go through and separate out the people who are in trouble for sort of honest reasons from the people who bought three times as much house as they needed and should have known better.
Well, I think it may be possible to separate it out on the basis of how bad their situation is. Just I don't think you can separate it out on that basis, but you might be able to separate out in terms of how deeply in trouble they are. Do they have any chance
of getting back on track.
And that's a kind of an economic decision that has to be made with the paperwork in front of them and an honest assessment of what their income is. I mean, imagine this. It was going to be nearly impossible for some people to make it with the adjustable rate mortgages that would increase in the out years from teaser rates that were very low to more higher rates, okay, in good times. Now people are losing their jobs. Now people are downsizing. Now people are having to go to part-time, et cetera. They don't have a prayer in the world. So those are the kinds of things that have to be taken into consideration in restructuring a mortgage.
What needs to change so that we're sure that people who take on a mortgage really understand what it is they've just signed up for?
It's two pieces. First of all, the banks have to be more stringent. Even responsible institutions, like Countrywide, caught the fever and started doing things against their own better judgment because it was a boom. And there's a lot to be said for what happens in a boom psychology. You know, people come to the business who have no business being in housing finance or housing. And so the first thing is return to some common sense standards of lending stringency, okay? And the second is we've got to do a lot more in terms of housing counseling. For example, the group that I've spoken to today, the North Texas Housing Coalition, is involved in housing counseling. Actually, retail level, grassroots level, one-on-one, telling people whether they're ready or not, helping them determine whether or not they can afford it, and helping them understand the full dimensions of home ownership, which is not just signing and making your payment. There are maintenance issues. They're sustaining the home. There's tax questions. There's a lot of things that are not inherently obvious to the uninformed.
Have you spoken to Sean Donovan, the president?
I have. I spent an hour and a half with him in New York in his office about 3 weeks ago, and then a little time in the inauguration this week.
Can you talk?
And I'm having dinner with him on Monday night.
Was it a time when you said, here's what I have to tell you, or did he say, here are my questions for you?
A couple of things. A little of the both. One, you may know I wrote a book with Jack Kemp on what bipartisan housing policy ought to look like in the United States. If we came to the center, and as America has always done when it's advanced housing policy, I mean, there was a time when Mr. Housing in America was Senator Robert Taft, a Republican from Ohio, and President Truman passed the 1949 Housing Act, which is the standard for a decent and safe home for every American. So we need to be bipartisan, and Jack Kemp, my predecessor as HUD secretary, who's a Republican, and I wrote a book describing what the consensus American posture on housing ought to be, from homelessness to rental to public housing to entry-level home ownership, et cetera. So that's what I talked to Sean about. He knew the book, and I've known him for a long time. He's really a high quality guy, but he also had a lot of questions about personnel selections, the order of importance of the various sections of the department, some of the particular challenges. For example, if we're going to do mortgage modifications on a large scale, it's going to involve FHA, and FHA is not up to speed. They don't have the personnel. Infrastructure today in skills or in numbers of people to do this. So, you know, the things we know need to be done are going to require some real management.
How long will that take?
They're going to have to do it quickly. I mean, the next 6 months to a year, if they're going to engage, you know, in being part of the solution to build this country back. It's one of the things you have to worry about that says this recession may take longer than we think, because it just takes a while. Even when billions of dollars are being allocated to solve problems, you got to have troops on the ground to execute.
Henry, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Chris.
Really appreciate it.
Yeah.
Just ahead on Think, an artist explores terrifying beauty in the shape of a nuclear bomb. First, take a look at this week's arts calendar.
The Art and Seek calendar for this weekend includes a Dallas Gallery show, the Gypsy Jazz Giant, and Donizetti. For a musical clash between royals and rebels, don't miss the first weekend of the Dallas Opera's production of Roberto Devereux at the Fair Park Music Hall. In Fort Worth, celebrate Gypsy Jazz legend Django Reinhardt and Brazilian composer Antonio Carlos Jobim, as Arts Fifth Avenue hosts their 6th annual Django Reinhardt Festival, 3 days of French ambiance, film, and unforgettable music. Also in Fort Worth, it's the preview weekend for Nobel Prize-winning author Toni Morrison's heart-wrenching coming-of-age drama, The Bluest Eye, presented by Jubilee Theatre. And brand new at the Andor Gallery in Dallas, 4 artists explore the idea of characters within their work via painting, photography, mixed media, and video, and the gallery's 21st show, Protagonist. For more about these events, join us at artandseek.org. For Art and Seek, I'm Jeannie Mascoro.
Why would an artist make replicas of the most destructive weapons ever unleashed on humankind? And what does such work force viewers to think about? Robert Wilhite's sculptural representation of the bomb dropped by U.S. forces on Japan at the end of World War II tends to evoke complicated emotional responses. One of his sculptures is featured in the Barry Whistler Gallery's group show, Inaugural 09. Robert, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure being here.
It was, I understand, very important to you that the exact dimensions were reproduced in the sculpture that you made. Can you talk about why that was so critical to you?
One of the reasons I made the bomb in the first place, or the replica of it, was to make it real to people. And I approached it as an art piece. And I've always been fascinated how energy and power get put into objects. I mean, as an artist, one tries to make an object that is greater than the sum of its components. And it has that special invisible thing. So with the bomb project, I went to the Atomic Energy Museum in Albuquerque, and I measured the carcass of the bomb that was dropped on Nagasaki. It's called the Fat Man bomb, and it was actually the second bomb that was dropped, but it was the same as the first bomb that was exploded, called the Gadget. And I think that in most people's mind, when they see the Fat Man bomb, that's the bomb that they think of that was actually dropped on Hiroshima, but it wasn't that one. It was another bomb called the Little Boy. But it was important to me that people stand next to what is the profile and the size of the actual bomb. My bomb weighed about 135 pounds, 150 pounds, something like that. The original bomb was 10 feet 8 inches long and 5 feet in diameter, and weighed 10,800 pounds. I wanted people to come in and stand in front of my artwork and look at it and say, this is really beautiful. And at the same time, say to themselves, wait a minute, this is really horrible. I wanted them to confront that because nuclear weaponry is real. It's not far away. It's right there, and I wanted people to stand next to it.
Well, and we have the same sort of ambivalent relationship to those weapons because many people don't like the idea that they exist, but they figure if someone has to have them, we want to be in possession of them ourselves.
Well, one thing I can say about Reagan was that he tried to dismantle the whole nuclear arsenal. And there was one country that gave up their bomb. I don't know if you're familiar with this. But South Africa actually got the bomb and had it. They got the bomb from Israel. And they gave it up. It's the only country that has. So for the pieces that I'm showing at Barry Whistler's gallery, I'm showing a tactical nuclear weapon that we produced, the United States, called the Davy Crockett. And it's 30 inches long and 11 inches in diameter and had the power of 1 megaton. And we deployed them in the field for 11 years. And one of the reasons I'm making 9 of them, one for each country in the Nuclear Club. And one of the reasons why I chose that piece was that it's really cute and it's really deadly. And it could be shot off in the field from a tripod or from the nuclear cannon or a couple of other devices, including the backpack nuclear weapon. But it could be shot off and go between a mile and a half and 2.25 miles. And the radiation actually encompassed the people that set it off. And I felt that it was a perfect example of the futility of the whole nuclear weapon thing. So I'm making 9. And one of them will be in the exhibition at Barry's.
You grew up during the Cold War. How much was the threat of a nuclear attack part of what you thought about when you were a kid?
Well, we all practiced climbing underneath our desks.
And duck then and cover.
Yeah. And then we realized that all the people that climbed underneath their desk, if there was something that went down, they were crushed underneath their desk, and the only safe place to be was in the aisles, which is something I found out later. But it's like television. It wasn't real. It was just something you did, like walk out of the school and go out onto the playground if something else was going on. It was just a test. It wasn't real. And I made my bomb to make it real.
So was it in part to make it real for you?
That's a good question. It was to make it real for others. When I was much younger, right out of college, I joined a water circus that traveled around in Japan for 6 months. And one of the towns that we performed in was Hiroshima. And I went there, and I stood at Ground Zero, and I tried to imagine the horror that actually took place. And it was real. And I looked at the Peace Park, and I went through the museum there that had graphic photographs of the horror. And it was real, and I thought about it for a long time. And in making art, I made the piece because I'm fascinated with the power of objects. And so I thought, what happens if you take the most powerful object in the world and you try to make it? Will it still have that power, and what will it do? And that's one of the reasons also that I made the piece.
My understanding is that you would like to see these ultimately put in a place where lots of people can come visit them as opposed to at an individual's house. Is that part of anticipating that the meaning of this will change over time for people?
No. I don't think it'll change with time. I think that what it does is it makes it real, like I've said. Because people can walk around it and see how big it is. And I find it fascinating to watch people's response to the piece.
And do you worry that people will walk around it so often that they don't see it anymore?
No. From the front of the piece looks solid. And as you walk around it, you see through the piece, and it becomes transparent and it becomes light. And the impact is the silhouette. And also the bulkheads of the sections as it goes along are cut out so that they represent pulleys like in a mechanism. And I've been fascinated by the whole modernist age for a long time, and it seemed like the bomb was really a continuation of that.
Sorry, we're out of time.
Okay.
It's been great to have you, Robert.
Thank you.
You can see Robert Wilhite's work at the Barry Whistler Gallery in Dallas through February 28th. To access our free podcast, you can go to the Think page of KERA's website. Our email address is think@kera.org. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for being with us, and have a great week.
Think is made possible in part by Guaranty Bank, using its more than 100 years of business experience to provide financing for small and medium-sized businesses and independent oil and gas producers throughout Texas. By Perot Systems, a technology services company trusted by more than 500 clients worldwide. Perot Systems delivers technology infrastructure services, consulting, application solutions, and business process solutions that enable growth. By Southwest Securities, a nationally recognized regional brokerage firm that's been meeting the needs of Southwest investors for more than 30 years. Southwest Securities is a member of the New York Stock Exchange and SIPC. By the Executive Education Center at the University of Texas at Dallas, providing degree and non-degree programs to help corporate professionals and executives stay ahead. On the web at som.utdallas.edu/executive. And by the valued support of KERA members. Thank you.